Hey, this is Scott Snyder, and you're listening to Shed Talk.
Add your kids. Add your wife. And add your husband because they're raping everybody out here.
Coming straight at you from the heart of the California Redwoods, it's Shed Time.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Winning. My jokes are bad. Watchmen Chapter 4. Watchmen Chapter 4 is basically the chapter that brings us the real character of Dr. Manhattan. It's all written from Dr. Manhattan's perspective, and it begins on Mars. Of course, with Chapter 3 having given us the impetus for Dr. Manhattan wanting to leave Earth, going to Mars, his loss of Lori to Spechnik, of course, and coupled with the fight's plot have basically shown how human he truly still is, leaving Earth, wanting to be left alone. And he sits on Mars with the photograph of he and Janie Slater when he was still just John Osterman. We're given this really interesting metaphor that every one of us that can see, at least, have this experience when we look at the night sky, or at the sky in general, or anywhere, I guess technically anywhere, but just the most pronounced examples, of course, being when you look at the stars at night, we're literally looking at the time, just like we're looking at a photograph, only it's real.
We're looking at the past, exactly.
It's literally, we're looking at the past, because that's how long, you know, however many light years it takes those photons to travel, that's how many years we're seeing into the past.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting way to sort of look at how Dr. Manhattan must experience reality and his perspective, being that, you know, his memories, it's like he's experienced the past, present, and future at the same time, as long as his mind's eye is staring at that, I suppose.
Sure, yeah, he can.
His attention's on it.
Yeah, right, yeah, he can.
Kind of like the Eye of Sauron.
Yeah, right, yeah. He can see anything he looks at, but he can't look at everything at once, so.
So he's not, obviously he's not omnipotent.
No, or omniscient.
Omniscient.
Although he's, you know, all that knowledge is at his disposal, but at any given moment he's not, you know, privy to it.
We obviously at the end of 3, we're given this basically this sort of look into Dr. Manhattan, the god, how different he has become. I guess you could kind of think of it his reaction to people, but I think it's sort of the opposite though, where you see
people's reaction to him.
Reacting to him is really he's like an intellect. He's just like a super intellect.
Not callous in any way, though, but definitely a super intellect. With some very human emotions,
Right, it's just that his perception's so different. But he's still an emotional being. He has to deal with these emotions that are reacting to a perception that is so radically different than how we experience reality.
His newfound powers and abilities and knowledge and stuff like that in perspective, they don't make him anything other than, they don't make him non-human. He's not so beyond us that he's no longer human. He's a human with all those powers, and they're a burden on him, I think, to some extent. We're seeing how a human being deals with those powers.
I mean, after all, he's sitting by himself on Mars staring at a picture of when he was a regular person.
Right, yeah.
When he was John Osterman, when he was just hanging out with Janie Slater, you know, in love with her. Maybe this is the simplicity of that moment. Mm-hmm. And just, And just because certainly that Gibbons has drawn him, especially in the beginning of the chapter, there seems to be like a longing on his face or a sorrow for sure.
I think when he sees that picture, he's almost marveling at all the things he can still identify with that John Osterman, and all the things that he cannot at all identify with. And yet, it's the same guy.
Yeah, so chapter four, we're given his origin, his father, the watchmaker, on the day that Hiroshima, the bomb is dropped on Hiroshima. He immediately goes and tells John, don't fuck with these watches anymore.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You're going to become a physicist. His dad seems rather forceful in a lot of ways. Pretty serious fucking guy, at least in the bit we're given.
Domineering and controlling, yeah.
Seems like it, just in the tidbit that we're given. Yeah, he just dumps the watch parts right across, over the balcony.
His father was a watchmaker, so you'd expect him to appreciate the... You wouldn't expect a watchmaker to be so over watches that he would just dump a bunch of perfectly good gears or cogs over a balcony, but whatever, that's what he does, and John follows him out and lunges forward to try to catch them.
What are you doing, father? In the book, I remember right after you see part where you see the father throw the gears off the balcony, you get a little glimpse of stuff that happens later in the comic all of a sudden. So you get this glimpse of John Osterman sort of, they don't really show very much of it, but they show like the balcony of Dr. Manhattan standing on the glass palace that he creates later in the chapter, which hasn't been created in the beginning of the chapter. I remember the first time you read this, you don't know what the fuck's going on in a way.
You're not sure what you're looking at.
Yeah, it's like, well, what is that?
He talks about a meteor shower. You could tell it's a meteor shower, but the spires and the balcony that he's standing on.
And of course, throughout the whole chapter, he's sort of waiting for this meteor shower to happen. Yeah. But at the same time, he could always go and see it in his mind happening in the future.
Exactly. As if it's happening right now, because all moments, past, present, and future, are not happening simultaneously for him, but they're all present moments that can be revisited infinitely.
No, that's good.
In the beginning, I think maybe just to ease the reader into his perspective, he speaks using past tense a little bit, but by this point in the issue, by the time he's talking about his father and he goes from panel to panel, switching between time periods, between panel to panel, I mean, talking about the past in one panel, talking about the future in another,
right?
He abandons talking in past tense.
It's awesome.
He's in present tense the rest of the time, and yet you still always know there's no confusion. You know exactly what he's talking about because he gives the year.
Absolutely. And I have to give Alan Moore, for a single issue, if I were to take this as a single issue, this is one of the best written comics I've ever read. I mean, it's just
this issue here.
This is an incredible issue. This is like mastery of the comic book art form right here. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. Just the way it's written, the way that it's completely believable. It's incredible. I mean, back to chapter four. So you sort of get the sense that John Osterman does what his father says.
Yeah.
Goes and becomes a physicist, gets his PhD, and starts working at Gila Flats, which is a nuclear research facility run by the U.S. government. He becomes employed by the U.S. government working at this facility, and there he meets the first love of his life, Janie Slater. And, of course, in Chapter 3, we see Janie Slater, an angry Janie Slater, accusing Dr. Manhattan of giving her cancer, via...
Just exposure to Dr. Manhattan.
Right.
Exposure to him.
But anyway, we get to see the early part of their relationship, how they get together. We see like this kind of crucial moment in Dr. Manhattan's origin unfold involving this watch. They're at the carnival, they're at the fair. You get to see their picture. You get to see them together, the exact same picture that's the picture that's taken of them while they're together that you see in the comic while he's on Mars. So there's that whole connection of the photograph with the moment when it happened of him experiencing that moment in the past again, which is a cool connection because you see the photograph that he has later in his hand in the future.
Right.
It kind of ties in that moment, kind of it gives it sort of a linear feeling.
What happens at that carnival is sort of a linchpin, I guess.
Sure.
For the causal chain that ends up leading to the accident that makes him Dr. Manhattan.
Right. He reflects on it later in the chapter. And that's a key way to refer to it, a causal chain. Exactly.
Yeah, it's it is. It is whole. Really just one domino after another. And he recalls it in that fashion. He admits later on that if that fat man had not stepped on her watch and broke it, he would have had no reason to fix it and therefore leave it in the chamber and then have to go get it from the chamber and yada, yada, yada. So everything was almost engineered to lead him into that chamber. Not only was each part of the chain crucial, but it had to happen in exactly that order. And the dependence of not only the correct components, but them being reassembled in the correct order, that figures prominently later in this chapter, too. Right. It keeps coming up. That's a theme that keeps coming up. As a watchmaker's son, because, of course, the gears have, the cogs have to be arranged in a certain order as well.
Was it the fat man stepping on the watch?
Oh, yeah, which, like, yeah, right. Yeah,
which of these things was it?
You know? It's like asking, you know, what, did the bullet kill the person? Did my pulling the trigger kill it? Was it the gun?
Schrodinger's cat kind of stuff? No, that's more quantitative. Well, we can get into that later.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. But,
right. But more so like identifying, I don't know, where in a causal chain you can attribute blame or something like that.
Sure.
Or say that this is what, yeah, I don't know. each part was is equally
important.
Thank you, yes.
Because if the watch was never smashed by the fat guy.
Yeah.
At the fair.
But if she had never dropped it, had to drop it, and if his mother-in-law was home, it would have never gone to the fair.
Right, and he would never have repaired the watch for her.
Yeah, I don't know how you can assign importance to one factor there, and not to everything else.
John Osterman gets stuck in the intrinsic field subtractor.
Mm-hmm. Subtractor.
Right.
I see.
So basically, yeah, I don't want to get too into how the intrinsic field subtractor works, because I don't fully understand it. I have to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, I think it has something to do with breaking atomic parts down. And somehow it breaks down atomic structure or something and separates, I don't know, molecules, atoms. And John Osterman gets stuck in there. They can't open it up, and he gets vaporized, essentially.
Yeah.
Totally. His body just ceases to exist. Slowly, after this deconstruction, he starts reconstructing himself.
Piece by piece, just in the same fashion that he was dismantled. But here again, the same thing I was mentioning just a little bit ago, the fact that he says it explicitly. It's a matter of reassembling the pieces in the correct order here. Really, it's just a question of reassembling the components in the correct sequence. Because the same components put in out of whack or, you know, in a different sequence won't yield a functioning organism, mechanism, or whatever. So there's a sense in which he doesn't just see past, present, and future and takes it for granted as just like a brute fact that this is the way that history will unfold. He sees the inevitability of every moment in that sequence. He sees that it's the way it is because it couldn't have possibly been any other way, given that all this other shit just happened before it. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just, I think that's an added something. It's not just something playing in front of him and he's a passive spectator. He sees the necessity behind the way everything is.
Yeah,
and that's what leads to his possible fatalism.
It's interesting. Yeah, right. It's almost like because there's so many causes in this chain and because there's no way for me to measure how things are going to come out, no way for Dr. Manhattan to truly measure how things are going to come out, therefore, there's no way to control it. Thus, sort of like this idea that you can make your own future, this idea that from Terminator, no fate but what we make kind of thing.
Well, yeah. Okay. Right.
Dr. Manhattan, certainly, it's clearly articulated that he believes in predetermination.
Because he does know exactly
I should clarify, because there's no way for him, and this is getting into quantum mechanics, I suppose, a little bit, about, you know, how time and how things move on the molecular level. Basically, how, like, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle states that, but essentially what it was is the principle was that you can't measure things on certain microcosmic levels, and even macrocosmic levels are immeasurable because
you can't,
even observing them, you're changing those.
Right, you're altering. You can't measure a subatomic particle's position and momentum at the same time. You can measure its position, but by doing so, you fuck up its momentum.
Sure.
And if you choose instead to measure its momentum, by doing so, you fuck up its position. So there's no way to do it without tampering with it, because you've got to ricochet a photon off the thing to measure it, and that impact is going to alter
and therefore, thing. Because there's no way to truly control these things, he believes that everything is already determined. You know what I mean?
That definitely takes control out of our hands.
Because even though he can see in the future, it's like he knows that there's no way he can stop what he's seeing from happening.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like he just believes that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's different from...
He knows it's going to happen. It's not just he doesn't believe. He knows
exactly.
It's going to happen.
He knows it. He knows that...
In his head, it's not like he can just change what's going to happen in the future in his head, and that's what's going to happen. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right. this flies in the face of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in that he's got perfect knowledge of past, present, and future, which means he doesn't know because his method of knowing doesn't rely on ricocheting photons off of things the way normal humans have to know it. He can know the position and momentum of every given particle. For him, it's still a Newtonian universe where everything's position and momentum can be measured, and if you know the position and momentum of every fucking particle in the universe, then you know exactly what's going to happen X amount of years down the line. You just do the math and find out where they're going to be at that point in time. So for him, nothing's changed. It's still a Newtonian universe. I see that now clearer than I saw before, because there's no uncertainty for him, because he knows things in a different... I don't know. They never really explain how it is that he comes to know things. He doesn't have to do the same sort of investigation, the same sort of... He doesn't have to employ the scientific method to learn things. He just fucking knows them through intuition, I suppose. He doesn't have to do a lot of... And yet he does have to do a lot of experimenting. What am I talking about? He's constantly rearranging those pieces in that compound that he lives in order to try to... What's he trying to achieve in there? I can't remember. He's trying to build something. So clearly he's not omniscient in the sense that he knows the laws of physics intuitively as if they were fucking ingrained in him. Yeah. He still has to figure that shit out for himself. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out how he knows things and how he comes to know them and what the extent of his knowledge is.
Before Watchmen.
Yeah, there you go. Right? Yeah.
He could basically just create things, right? Or basically he manipulates...
I don't know that he can.
I don't think I've ever seen him like. Yeah, exactly. He rearranges their structure.
There you go. Yeah.
Exactly.
Because he's got complete control over all four fundamental forces.
Yeah, and that's why he can just make people explode and shit.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, even when he puts the hydrogen atom on his forehead, he just kind of
Sears it on there, burns it into him. And even that seems like it's a display for the people around him so they don't get freaked out. Because he could have just blinked. He could have just done a fucking bewitch sort of little wink and fucking boom, it would have popped up there. So
that's interesting.
So much, I wonder how much of what he does he doesn't even have to do. It's just to make it more palatable to human minds so that they don't fucking freak the fuck out.
Right.
You know? Never having seen anything like this before.
Sure. There's an interesting scene he has with Hollis Mason in the midst of Chapter 4. That's an interesting meeting because basically it's kind of like the passing of the torch, or just things have changed. This is the moment where it really occurs to you that Dr. Manhattan is sort of like the Axis Mundi, or the center of the whole Watchmen world, because his mere presence have changed how things are so much in the timeline that is shown and that's given to us in Watchmen. I mean, first of all, Hollis Mason basically is like, okay, you know, I'm retiring. I'm getting old, but at the same time, because somebody like you exists, we're obsolete. This is serious. You have, like, real superpowers. And of course, being Dr. Manhattan being the only real human on the Earth and Watchmen that has real superpowers.
Yeah.
But then we get into this whole how his existence has changed, you know. There's the sort of the fossil fuel economy is gone, it seems. At least within automobiles, they're all electric because...
Or they're soon to be. They're about to be.
Right. But in the 1985, when they're in New York in 1985 and shit, you see all the cars that are driving by them are all electric and everything.
I see. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's that part later in the chapter when he's walking and all the cars going by making funny sounds and they don't do that in the movie. They stay away from that. I don't know why they shied away from it. They should have. God, I don't want to get.
But this scene didn't even make it into the movie.
No.
Where he talks with Mason. I don't remember it either. Yeah.
But and then he does the devil kick. He's like, I'm just going to go repair automobiles again, you know.
Right, yeah.
He's like, oh, well, they're all going to be electric soon.
What strikes me about this is two things. Yeah, okay, there's the sign in front of Hollis Mason's shop actually says, you know, we repair obsolete models or something like that. And the first thing you think of is it's an obvious allusion to the fact that the Watchmen themselves are obsolete models. So that's, okay, that's kind of in your face. But the thing that really struck me about this scene is I can't tell whether... Am I supposed to realize from this scene that, okay, basically, is Manhattan being a dick? Or is this showing that Manhattan has sort of lost touch with other human beings because he doesn't realize that what he's saying here is kind of...
Well, I think...
dickish.
At least my reaction is he's trying to be genuinely, like, nice. Or, like,
okay.
Hey.
He hears Hollis Mason say, hey, I'm going to retire, but at least I got my fucking, I can repair cars. And then Manhattan's like, yeah, well, I'm introducing the electric car next month because I can now build the lithium, or I can construct the lithium artificially to make the batteries necessary.
I think he was just trying to make conversation, and I don't even think it struck him that he was being a dick.
Okay, yeah. Okay, there's, I mean, the effect it had on Mason was clear. That, right, oh, right. Wow, okay, fuck, sure. Great. Now I'm really obsolete, doubly so. Okay, so I'm with you. He wasn't, Manhattan wasn't intentionally being a dick. He was accidentally being a dick. But
yeah, sure.
Still a dick,
sure,
nonetheless. And it's because he's losing his ability to predict,
and we see that,
the emotional, right, reactions, right, of other,
exactly,
human beings,
and
to
and
his
and
behavior.
Kind of, the parts right after that in the chapter are Janie Slater getting pissed at him because he's been so out of touch.
Yeah.
Because she's scared, you know. Mm-hmm. She's, yeah, all those feelings.
The same thing happens when, in 1985, when he tries to pleasure Lori with,
exactly,
like, three of themselves.
Exactly.
He thinks that's going to do,
right,
it for her, and
exactly,
he's surprised when she's mortified.
Well, Lori's a prude. I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Yeah, right. You should be more like her mother. Yeah. No. I'm on Lori's side on that one. I admit
that.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. The scene with Hollis Mason and this scene with Janie Slater,
uh-huh,
which she actually says, he gets her to admit that she's afraid of him. And that everyone's afraid of him because nobody knows what the extent of his powers are. Nobody knows what to expect from him. Nobody's, mm-hmm, ever had to deal with anyone with this much power. That the whole world is just as terrified of him as she is. So again, like you were saying in the beginning, it's more about how people react to him than how he reacts to them.
Then, of course, you know, the whole falling in love with Laura Dispechnik and, you know, basically trading the old model in for a new one, sort of thing. Huh?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
at least that's the way it's kind of shown, because it's Dr. Manhattan, you know. It's like, it basically doesn't age.
Yeah.
Like, as described, he's standing still in time. Sort of thing.
I always kind of assume that with his advanced intelligence,
uh-huh,
and I also kind of thought that he was becoming less emotional,
sure,
and more apathetic. I thought that would have had at least the side effect of killing his libido.
Oh, right. But, I see what you're saying.
But
apparently not.
Not only has it not, but now that I'm realizing that he hasn't lost the emotional component of his humanity, mm-hmm, at all, despite all his powers, then, you know, it sits okay with me that he's still got a libido and stuff like that. I mean, that's still very human. And,
well, that's interesting.
You know,
it's interesting.
Cool.
I think it's interesting you bring that up, because it's almost like his new perception has, I don't want to say it hasn't made him less moral. Maybe from I think it's made him less moral from our standards.
Mm-hmm.
But from his perception and how he sees things, well, I think a lot of societal constructs don't make sense to him anymore.
No, know? I could definitely,
like,
see
who
that.
Who cares if, you know, he's like,
who cares if she's 16?
Yeah, exactly. Who cares,
right?
If she's 16? Who cares if there's two of me or three,
yeah,
of me?
Yeah,
know?
Right, okay.
Like,
yeah.
It doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Anyway.
No, I can see that, definitely, yeah.
And you see that a lot.
That's good.
Right after that with Comedian. Mm-hmm. When he's hanging out with Comedian in Vietnam, and his observations of Comedian, like,
yeah, okay,
how basically, in a lot of ways, his view of him is how the Comedian viewed himself also, which is interesting, I think. A reflection of the human condition.
You're saying Manhattan viewed the Comedian in much the same way that
the comedian viewed himself.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
Yes, right. That's what I'm,
yeah,
saying. I think that they're dead on with each other about it.
Okay, yeah.
And the way that Manhattan talks about him is interesting, too. You know, it's sort of like an analysis. He was, mm-hmm, like, he's just analyzing, mm-hmm, the Comedian, and it's like he understands the Comedian.
He says earlier in the chapter that, you know, the only person he found interesting at the Minutemen meeting was yeah, Veidt. But he doesn't say why.
Sure.
Here, you're right, he gives an analysis of the Comedian's character.
Exactly.
And praise.
Nixon asks Dr. Manhattan to intervene in the Vietnam War, and he brings it to an end in a couple months, like 2 months or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the Vietnamese all surrender him personally. He's a god. He's, well, basically is a god. I mean,
yeah,
shit. The use of him in the Vietnam War, obviously, and this is maybe some speculation on my part, has obviously irked the Soviet Union.
Oh, okay,
you know,
yeah,
what I'm saying? It's probably made tensions worse, because all, yeah, of a sudden,
successfully
nuclear, the United States,
spread of communism.
The United States has more of a nuclear deterrent now.
It's not, you're,
you
right, it's,
mean,
not a stalemate.
It's not a stalemate anymore.
No.
And so the Soviet Union probably feels more threatened than,
yeah,
they have in the past,
yeah,
being that the United States has such an advantage now with Dr. Manhattan. They don't really get it too much into it. That's funny, maybe they will in Before Watchmen.
Maybe how many guys you think the Soviet Union killed trying to recreate another documentary? Oh, how many guys you think they threw in the chamber?
Don't fucking tempt me.
Before we move on, I think this is really good. I want to say specifically what Manhattan's analysis of the comedian is. The comedian permits himself certain knowledge about the human condition that most other people...
This is what Moore wrote.
Okay, go ahead.
He suits the climate here, referring to Vietnam, the madness, the pointless butchery. As I come to understand Vietnam and what it implies about the human condition, I also realize that few humans will permit themselves such an understanding. Blake's different. He understands perfectly, and he doesn't care.
So, the reason why most people wouldn't permit themselves this sort of understanding of the human condition is because they wouldn't be able to just, you know, take it as it is, take it for granted, and not care.
Right.
That's what makes, what makes the comedian different is that he can stomach it because he doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, and he doesn't buy into all the bullshit. Like, this is how the comedian referred to it. Like, all the bullshit, like all the societal bullshit that would keep you from doing those things.
You know what I'm saying? Right, yeah, definitely. This might be a stretch, but think of the lyrics to Vicarious.
Okay.
And how it's all about how everyone thinks they're moral people, but they're all just a bunch of voyeurs, and they all have the same drives to watch misery happen and unfold before them. The comedian knows that we're all a bunch of sadists.
The lyrics are eye on the TV because tragedy thrills me.
There you go. Yeah, there's something about you can deny it, but you're just lying to yourself. I don't know the words themselves. I can't remember them right now. But if that jogs anything in your memory,
whatever flavor it happens to be, like
it's Maynard, or I'm assuming he writes his own lyrics, calling everyone out on believing that I would never stop to look at the fucking carnage of a train wreck or something like that. But everyone wants to. We all have this sick fucking desire to. It's just the animal part of us. Maybe that's not specifically what the comedian or Dr. Manhattan talk about, the voyeuristic nature of our fucking wanting to see other things suffer.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I was a cop and I was doing something, people would fucking slow down and stare and fucking
I bet what the hell
is going down.
It's a morbid curiosity, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's just one example of the animal nature that that humans, at least in the West, have been trying to... We want to think that our huge neocortices make us not animals anymore, that we are no longer animals. Right, but what the comedian realizes is that we're a bunch of really, really smart fucking monkeys.
Yeah.
And we still just want to fucking kill and do all these primitive things.
We're smart enough to fucking make guns and flamethrowers.
Right, exactly. But they're still weapons of destruction. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
we're smart.
But that's all we are. We're just smart enough to make more advanced weapons, but we're not smart enough not to do all these really primitive animal things. And that's what the comedian isn't kidding himself about.
And that's our true face is those instincts.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely. A true anarchist. at least partially, in the political sense, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, the meeting that they depict between Veidt and Dr. Manhattan while he's at his Antarctic base, which obviously becomes important in the later chapters of the story. I think the contrast between Veidt and Manhattan is interesting, being that Veidt is a man, somebody that totally believes that he can control the future. He can control what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas getting back to what we talked about, Manhattan believes that you can't control it all.
There's no control at all. It's a total illusion.
And it's all determined.
Already. Yeah, right. You think you're choosing, but you're not.
I mean, obviously, Manhattan doesn't believe in free determination in the sense that there's like a God that maps it out. There's a consciousness that does it.
Right.
He just believes that, that the way that reality is, there's nothing we can do to change what's going to happen.
It's just a bunch of billiard balls bouncing around.
Exactly.
And yeah, exactly. They're going to bounce the way the math says they're going to bounce, and no other way.
Because it's so chaotic that there's no way we could ever see what's going to happen. Exactly.
But there is, you're right about that contrast. And Veidt's right because he does pull strings. Well, no, they're both, no, there's no real way to, there are two different ways of, you know what, the free will determinism argument, debate, whatever you want to call it, is a lot like the particle wave dualism thing of quantum mechanics.
Okay, yeah.
In that you can use either one to describe reality, but not both at the same time. You can see everything as particles, or you can see everything as waves, but you can't see them both as particles and waves at the same time. Pick your picture and apply it to the reality.
Particles traveling on waves.
Yeah, right. See, that doesn't work. Right? A lot of physicists have tried to do that, but you can't homogenize them. Same thing. You can see the world as causally determined. All the facts will fit. Or you could see it Veit's way, that we have free will and we can make a difference in the world. And look, I obviously have. Look at my plan. It's unfolding perfectly.
It's
obviously
flawless.
I can't. It's flawless, yeah. They're two different goggles that you can wear and still see the world through them. And the facts will fit both pictures, just not at the same time.
It's flawless, except for Rorschach's diary, of course.
But, that's true. See, okay, anyway. There you go. Oh, that's a good one. Good, good point, good point.
Anyway, we'll get it out later.
That's the one thing he didn't expect. Or he couldn't have predicted. That's great. That is good stuff.
While Manhattan's on Mars, we see a full display of his powers. He totally erects that palace, that glass palace out of the sand. And he basically takes the molecules in the sand and turns them all to glass. You know, maybe he heats them up super hot.
Yeah, sure. Pressure.
Creates glass out of the sand.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's cool.
Still some physical process.
It's a great scene. It's great. That was one of the coolest scenes for the movie.
Yeah, it was.
When
he
did that.
Pretty good job with that.
That was good. You see this full display of his powers, and he builds the glass palace.
He says, while he's building it, part of his inner monologue is he wonders whether he's choosing the contours of the palace or whether they're already, as if already in the marble, and they're guiding his hand. The contours are pre-existent and guiding his hand. So even he doesn't know whether he's got free will or not. If I was Dr. Manhattan, it would be very difficult not to be a causal determinist and a fatalist. Because for him, I think his perspective jibes best with relativity theory. Because for him, every moment is in time is like a location that he can direct his gaze at. And so he sees everything as the four-dimensional space-time continuum, and the temporal dimension, the fourth dimension, is just as spatial as any of the other three dimensions. And so when he looks at a certain moment in the past, it's like looking over there. It's a location on the four-dimensional grid, no different than any other. And from his point of view, at the center, it's all right there in front of him. Like the catcher behind the plate, you can see the entire field in front of him.
Getting back to the causal chain, the part where Moore writes, in 1945, the bombs are falling on Japan. The cogs are falling on Brooklyn. Seeds of the future sown carelessly. Without me, things would have been different. If the fat man hadn't crushed the watch, if I hadn't left it in the test chamber, am I to blame then for the fat man or my father for choosing my career? Which of us is responsible? Who makes the world? This question of God, this question of causality.
Yeah.
What propels us in
Or at
into
what
the
point
future?
Do
what propels
you,
us and what has guided us along to where we're at now?
And at what point in a causal chain do you affix responsibility? Because he's asking himself, who's to blame for my being the way I am? My father for choosing my career, the fat man for stepping on the watch, me for negligently leaving it in the chamber. Like I was saying before, the classic.
And all of those things had to happen in order in order for him to have become Dr. Manhattan.
So you can't you can't choose one of the bunch, right?
Exactly. There's not one of those things. They all had to happen.
Exactly.
And it totally reminds me of from my religion, you know, from some of my studies from back in college. Things like the Bhagavad Gita, the chariot metaphor from there. You know, what makes up the chariot? Arjuna's on his chariot. What makes up the chariot? You know, this whole question of what makes the chariot? Is it the horses? Is it the reins? Is it the you know? Is it the wheels? Is it the obviously it's not one of those things. It has to be a combination of every. Of But the point of me bringing it up is that, and this wasn't necessarily what you get from the Bhagavad Gita, but it's also something you would get from Zen Buddhism. This whole nothing truly exists because everything is so interdependent upon each other.
Oh, yeah, you know No, nothing independent and concrete exists. Yeah, right.
None of those things.
Everything is dependent on something else.
Absolutely.
Conditional and contingent upon it.
Our bicycle or the car you drive.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, what makes your car? What makes you? You know, is it your eyes? Is it your fucking brain? Is
exactly.
Is it your skin?
You can cut off my arm
muscles?
And I'm still me. You can cut off both arms. At what point can
at
you
what
not
point,
cut off anything
and
else?
And if, if somebody did cut me up in the pieces, what part of me is me?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, is there one of these parts that's me? The one part you find? I don't know. What about the rest of me?
What was the fucking Flight of the Conchords line? He broke his body off, dude. He cut his body off or something like that. The guy, oh, fuck it. No, might as well edit it out. Or find the sound bite and play it. Dave is fucking walking down the street. He's trying to explain to them how this guy's body got cut off and all that was left of him was his dick. And they're like, well, don't you mean he got his dick cut off? He's like, no, dude, he got his whole body cut off.
I mean, here in the United States, rivalries between rappers usually result in death or worse.
Yeah,
or worse. Isn't it the same way with rappers back in Newfoundland?
Well, I'm not sure. New Zealand.
Yeah, Jermaine and I, we're the only rappers, apart from Steve. But he's a lovely guy. He's very friendly.
Which rappers did you diss, Brett?
I just dissed all the rappers I could think of.
Oh, shit. You want to be careful, Brett. I heard of one rapper, he chopped this guy's whole body off. Just left the dick behind.
Do you mean they chopped off his dick?
No, I mean they held his dick and chopped his whole body off. That's all he was in the end. A dick.
For Dave, you are your dick, and your body is like an appendage of your
That's
dick.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. That was a long explanation for something that any Flight of the Conchords fan
So
knows.
Basically, if he'd they only got known it right away. Yeah, if right. he'd only got his dick cut off, then he wouldn't be
his body.
Dave or whoever.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You wouldn't be Dave anymore if you lost your dick. Basically, the point I was trying to make is that the interdependence, even on something like a time scale or why things have led to be, is we've hammered it.
When a person gets, when a person dies of a gunshot wound, what do you say killed them? The bullet, the gun, the trigger, the pulling of the trigger, the finger that pulled the trigger,
right.
The guy who pulled the trigger, the parents who gave birth to the guy. Yeah, I mean, it fucking can
go. All right, right. Well, that's gone a little far. I mean, I'd argue. I mean, we could all have our arguments.
Right.
Sure.
I think it's obvious. See, that's a good example of an obvious one, where it's like, well, wait a minute, all those things played a part, but
as
human beings deserve blame and responsibility.
The person pulling
the
trigger.
So you hold the fucking person.
Ultimately, ultimately, the person pulling the trigger is responsible.
Right, exactly.
But, I mean,
or the guy that paid him to do it, it does get complicated.
Sure.
They're all guilty of murder, but it might be first degree on one guy's part. I don't know. Okay, you're right, that's a convoluted example. But still, no, it just goes to show that.
Arrest that man's parents.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. Well, no, fucking Leopold and Loeb got off for killing that kid because they studied fucking, what's his name, Darrow. I forget his first name. Their lawyer, famous lawyer, fucking argued that because they read Nietzsche in college, they were exposed to fucking, immorality being put up on a pedestal, and it's because they were exposed to Nietzsche
That's
that
crazy.
They fucking killed that kid, and they fucking got off.
That's crazy.
They were given life, I think, but they got out of the death penalty because of that.
All right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it happens. It definitely fucking happens. People argue that way and get away with it. It's crazy. If a person's parents were abusive enough, they could get off on murder like the fucking Menendez brothers, right? That shit happens.
Menendez brothers, man. I remember that. Yeah. No.
Yeah, right?
I mean, O.J. I don't get too far.
Yeah, okay, fine.
What am I bringing O.J. up for?
Yeah.
Anyway. Fucking O.J. At the end of the chapter, we have a floating, meditating Dr. Manhattan gazing at his creation.
Watching the meteor shower, which he knew was going to happen.
Which he knew was going to happen at the beginning of the chapter.
He knew he'd be there watching it. He knew exactly where he'd be standing while he was watching it. Nothing comes as a surprise to him.
And he knew that there was nothing he could do to not
alter that.
Alter what was going to happen. He knew. Right.
I mean, that's good. Fucked. You're just a passive, just a spectator. You're just along for the ride. That's all he is just along for the ride.
So that makes
he watches his hands do things and is like, wow, okay, I guess that's what I'm doing now. He's just the eyes in his head seeing it all unfold, has no control over his body.
And so, and it's
no sensation of choosing.
So it's interesting to how Veidt sort of, we get into it later on, how Veidt basically prevents him from seeing the immediate future.
Oh, yeah, with the tachyons, yeah.
So he doesn't know what's going to happen.
That's true. It can be blocked, which is great, which is more evidence in Veidt's favor.
I think Chapter 4 really cements what the Watchmen world is like, or what it is. You know what I mean? How it's the first four chapters really round out what the Watchmen world gives us the foundation and the meat of the story. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What we're about to move into. As the plot starts thickening, it literally starts to thicken. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the end of Chapter 4 really is a great foundation for the rest of the story.
Being that Dr. Manhattan is such a huge part of this world, his origin story definitely shades their world some, I don't know how to, yeah, the rest of the book is going to have to be very different from the first few chapters now that you know what, you know, the role he plays in this world. That's how I want to say it. It colors the rest of the, it colors the first few chapters if you were to reread them after reading chapter four. That's what I want to say.
It's Saturday, October 12th, 1985, and we are being informed of Edward Blake's murder. Lori's mood seems restless for the remainder of the weekend. Wednesday, the 16th, Lori is visiting her mother while I attend Blake's funeral. A thin man in a black coat leaves roses, then walks away. Do I know him? Saturday, the 19th now. My hands encircle Lori's face. In 1959, I am telling Janie I shall always want her. It's later. Lori is walking out on me. On a rooftop in the past, I pull her 16-year-old body to me, breathing her perfume, never wanting to lose her, knowing that I shall. Later still, and in the crowded TV studio, I am being accused of killing those closest to me. I am tired of this world, these people. I am tired of being caught in the tangle of their lives. In Arizona, I'm entering the ruined bar with a sensation of deja vu, and I'm taking the snapshot from its broken frame. And I'm gone. Gone to Mars. Gone to a place without clocks, without seasons, without hourglasses to trap the shifting pink sand. Below me, in the sand, the secret shape of my creation is concealed, buried in the sand's future. I am ready to begin. A world grows up around me. Am I shaping it, or do its predetermined contours guide my hand? In 1945, the bombs are falling on Japan. The cogs are falling on Brooklyn, seeds of the future sown carelessly. Without me, things would have been different. If the fat man hadn't crushed the watch, if I hadn't left it in the test chamber, am I to blame then, or the fat man, or my father for choosing my career? Which of us is responsible? Who makes the world? Perhaps the world is not made. Perhaps nothing is made. Perhaps it simply is, has been, will always be there. A clock without a craftsman. I am standing on a balcony of pink sand hardened to glass. It glitters in the 10-minute-old sunshine. The light of 2 hours past will just be reaching Pluto. If they have strong telescopes there, they can see me. The photograph in my hand, falling, lying in the sand at my feet. I am standing on a fire escape in 1945, reaching out to stop my father, take the cogs and flywheels from him, piece them all together again. But it's too late. Always has been. Always will be too late. Above the Notus Gordii Mountains, jewels in a makerless mechanism, the first meteorites are starting to fall.
So, what seems to be the problem?
I'm depressed. Life seems harsh and cruel. I feel alone in a threatening world where what lies ahead is vague and uncertain.
Ah, yes. Well, the treatment is simple. Shed Talk broadcasts weekly, and there is a new episode tonight. You should tune in and listen to it. I'm sure it will pick you right up.
Shed Talk? But, Doctor, you don't understand.
I am Shed Talk!
I'm not a fan of Superman.
You set the bar pretty low.
Right. With that great reviews,
the way I always thought comics were cool.
That doesn't make any fucking sense.
I don't know.
I want to see that guy in space.
Exactly. There's nothing like, God, this is pretty good, but if he was in space.
I'm in the shed. I gotta be honest.
At least you have strong opinions about shit you don't know dick about.
Shed Talk is a podcast dedicated to bringing you the best from the past and present of comics, video games, movies, and all things pop culture. You can find Shed Talk on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or directly at shedtalk.podomatic.com.